You're a cat and he's a ferret.
Yes, he's a ferret.
Yeah. I don't see a cat.
You don't see a cat?
No, wait, but I'm not in the call properly. Let me see. Let me see if I go into the.
Oh, that's right. It's that old.
It yes. is a cat. Hello.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my regular co-host, Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
Hello, and with me, I figured I'd keep it short today. Hello, and with me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
And with us is special guest Mike Falick from, you said you were in Boston now?
Boston, yeah.
Baston?
Baston?
Yes, how it's pronounced.
Got to get to the car.
I still, to this day, believe they're all faking the accent, but they really aren't.
Oh, really?
It's very real. It's very thick and very real. Yeah, well, you know, there's a heavy Irish population here, so it's not a huge surprise. That's what if you go from Ireland, you know, you're deep in Ireland in talking like this, and then you just switch a little bit to Boston.
It's the
accent is not that much different. but I was saying that it tracks that it's Irish Catholic and then into Boston.
I don't know if you're familiar with this form of gotcha podcasting.
So, you used to be from New York, because I remember back when I used to listen to your former podcast, Wait, Don't Fuck Me.
Yeah.
Oh, is that a taboo subject now?
Well, it's debunked. It's not, you know, there's nowhere people can go to follow it. And to be honest, the podcast I'm doing now, Let's Start a Cult, is very much what I think is what I've been trying to drive out with things for a while, which is groupthink. Why there are ways people think getting them to evaluate that, which is what it's all about.
I like the last episode I listened to. You had a discussion with your co-host and the guest about why the word blowjob is a terrible description for what that is.
Yeah, if you guys want, I have a bunch of hot takes that aren't out yet on the episodes, if you want to do them, and then we'll put you in the episode. So I can drop some by you, and we can see how you feel about these things that, right, like blowjob is not really a great word just in terms of every aspect of it. And my co-host said, we, as part of our segment where we don't take a survey, he said, hey, we should rename that. So here's the few you guys can give me hot takes on.
Okay. Okay.
We shouldn't be upset about making fun of our mothers, or people get too upset about yo mama and mother jokes.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, I don't give a shit. Sorry, mom.
one of my favorite things is totally inoffensive your mother jokes, like absurdist non sequitur your mother jokes, like, hey, if it's okay, I'm going to be using the bathroom, and then I say something to the effect like, no, that makes too much sense as a appropriate mother joke.
Yeah, no, but I get what you're saying is that it's from right. Absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, like hey, go warm up the car. You can turn anything. Yeah. You can
hey, I'm gonna borrow the lawnmower. Your mom is a lawnmower. That would be more okay. My speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually did it. We did a segment on Tonight in San Diego that I was pretty proud of. It was instead of a roast battle, it was a toast battle where we just went back and forth complimenting each other.
Well, and then number two that we've done, these are, I have these in order of weeks, is we should rename blowjobs. So how do you guys feel about that?
I mean, it's unfortunately, it is kind of a standard. It is a shorthand that everybody uses, that everybody basically understands. But yeah, ever since I listened to that podcast, I've tried to think of something better. And I think you guys landed on bleep bloop, which is very,
it's cute.
What about just like a dick suck?
Onomatopoeish. Yes. I don't think anyone brought that up, but it is onomatopoeish. Yeah. It very much is.
My only thing, I'm not in love with blowjob because it doesn't make sense. That sounds like an occupation that a clown in a party palace might have.
So Keith, what's so funny is that when my co-host proposed this, I never thought that almost, I would say 70% of the people that we ended up did surveying, so many people were bothered by the fact that no actual blowing is involved, that no expiration of air is involved. I would have never guessed that. It's what that's why I love this show.
Is the fact that it's called a job. Like,
yeah, that was my problem as well.
Yeah, like we want it to be a fun thing. Like we should call it like Dicky Funds.
Hand job I'm fine with. I'm fine. That is a job.
Southern kisses.
Southern kisses. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean Cassidy, that's the groupthink thing is that when we were just on Video Game Outsiders, Michelle was making the point that and it'll be on the episodes as well, but it's like, why do we have to change it? It's like, oh, well, that's groupthink. That's groupthink right there. Is that, is it an insurmountable idea to change? And that's mm-hmm. what we're trying to figure out.
I'm okay getting rid of blowjob, but I like BJ
Maybe that's the key.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe if it could be called like a boner joke. Like I'm gonna whisper a little joke to your boner.
How about this one? This is a meaty one. You guys might like this.
Okay.
We should get rid of form letters.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, well, in reference to what?
Every form letter, everything that is, you have not been selected to live in this apartment. You should not, whatever it is.
Yeah, I agree. Anything that you take the time to actually apply for or whatever, I feel like should get some kind of a personalized response. Even if it's like taking a form letter format and then personalizing it more than just your name or whatever. Yeah, yeah. I agree. Fuck form letters.
I'm of two minds because at one point, yes, it does feel it's totally impersonal and it's like an extra fuck you on top of that you can tell they just sort of copy and paste one thing and then just put your name at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I like that rather than no response because then I go actually insane.
Yeah, but here's the thing. True. You get rid of the form letter and mm-hmm. you hire people to write real letters. Like, we got a jobs problem in this country, right?
Yeah.
That's somebody's job. There you go.
I would split the difference if I'm showing my hand and I would say, if you were rejecting me from something and you just sent me a single email with one word that said no, I would be over the moon happy. Just no.
Yeah.
Like, great. I don't have to read this whole thing. And it's not this weird thing where you think I'm being tricked by your form letter.
It's mm-hmm. true because, and honestly, you know from the first sentence. It's either we regret to inform you or congratulations,
right.
You're selected for. I don't read the rest of whatever's in there.
Unless they're doing the old tricko routine where they say, we regret to inform you that you're no longer going to be working at your former job because you now work here.
Then I wouldn't know. I would never know. I would never start at that job because I'd be like, oh, fuck those guys.
Here's how crazy I am, Cassidy. I now have to go read every rejection letter I've ever got to make sure that it's not like, we regret to that I didn't have.
Oh my God, I got into Harvard. What the hell?
I can't believe I was accepted to Hogwarts. Well, to tease a showdown that's happening in the future, and the reason that I'm on here is that I also think groupthink is a part of criticism and media criticism. And I think that there's a lot of opinions out there that maybe I'll talk more about on our showdown, Cassidy. But I think there's a lot of film opinions out there that I think are groupthink, that they're not necessarily legitimate.
Especially with the advent of Rotten Tomatoes, I would agree with that assessment. I think
appeared on their TV show, I also think that they are. I think people misinterpret what they meant. But me and Cassidy, well, I'll have to save that.
For the
showdown on Apocalypse, where
Superman
locked in a cage with a weird thing strapped to his head, and Wonder Woman. I want to be Wonder Woman, Cassidy. You can't take it from me.
All yours. All yours. Speaking of film criticism,
I tried to get it away from the nonsense about my show is general nonsense. So the longer you talk to me, I'm like, wow, what an interesting nonsense. Go on for another 3 hours. So I tried to provide you an opening, Cassidy. I hope I did it.
You did. Okay. Here we go. We're going to get into the movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
And we do have quite a few stories. We'll just try and stick with hot takes here.
Yeah.
And leave the rest of the show for the actual reviews. And I believe all of us have seen Logan Lucky, the Death Note movie, and Iron Giant. Who's seen what?
I've seen
Death Note and Iron Giant. I have not seen Logan Lucky.
I saw everything.
Okay, cool. Then that works. That'll work. Let's get into this one. Lately, we've been doing a lot of stories about sort of Hollywood whitewashing. That's the hot topic lately.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is kind of an interesting turn on that. Ed Skrein, the actor, has left the Hellboy movie by his own accord. He read, he didn't know that much about the character, and then he read somewhere that the character is supposed to be Asian. He is not Asian, and he said, why am I cast as this part? And then he left.
What character was he going to play?
He was going to play Benjamin Daimio. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. Daimio,
yeah.
I think it's kind of... I think the real story is, why is he going to be in a Hellboy movie when Benjamin Daimio didn't even join the BPRD until Hellboy left it? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I feel like nerds have a bigger priority, which is like, get the story right. And then if you can do that, then let's focus on maybe the right races or don't care about the races, which is sort of the accepting side of comic book nerds, which is to say, make them whatever race you want. We don't care.
Oh, actually, I would completely disagree with that. Nerds get all up in arms if there is casting that is racially inappropriate, especially if it is going from a white character to any kind of ethnicity. Story issues aside, they freak out. A lot of fanboys have some issues.
Fair enough. I mean, you know, we can talk about like the timeline or whatever of like when this character is supposed to be in canon.
Oh, that was a joke.
I know.
Yeah,
because obviously the Guillermo del Toro movies took a million liberties with the source material, and most people are, you know, for generally positive about those.
Yeah, pretty.
This is not going to be a continuation of that series. This is going to be the new take by Neil Marshall. I think what's cool about this is that he left on his own, and I think that if we're going to keep talking about this as an issue in Hollywood, this is the way to deal with it. Rather than it being a Twitter outrage for a weekend, and then them deciding to do something about it, or them deciding not to do anything about it, or them deciding to weirdly justify it somewhere in the screenplay. I think this is the way to do it, is that it's in the actor's responsibility to say, I feel weird about this. How about no?
Yeah, I think it was a cool move by Ed Skrein. Honestly, when I first heard the story that Ed Skrein was being cast, my initial reaction was, who? And then I looked him up.
My reaction is, who? Who is he?
He played the villain in Deadpool.
Yeah.
Oh, that assumes
he's a guy.
I've seen Deadpool.
He was pretty unremarkable. Honestly, there is a cynical part of me that is like, okay, was he, did he do it just for the publicity? Because it worked. And I think whatever his motives are, it was the right move. Because I don't think he's right for the part. But I think he will, in the long run, benefit from it more than hurt his career.
Well, that's the attitude we all need to take, isn't it? The attitude we all need to take is we as a people will all benefit if we all take this attitude.
If we do the right thing and you'll be rewarded for it. Yeah.
Right. It's not even just his career. It's like, yeah, you will benefit from this thing. It's a hard thing to express to people, but it was, you know, after the Civil War, it was the same thing. Hire African Americans. You will benefit. It is not stupid to hire these people. They're here. Uh-huh. Hire them. Everyone will be better for it. We've said that it's been the same issue. And, you know, this is why I have not just respect, but like I don't understand how people can be race leaders, because it's like it's the same issue for 200 years. Stop casting. I mean, my favorite example of it is the Genghis Khan movie, which is, right, you know, where it's all British people. It's, hello, Genghis. How's it going? Apples and pears there, Genghis Khan. It's me, another Hun.
And honestly, we might get into this issue a little bit more with when we start talking about Death Note, but that's my feeling is cool for Ed. I agree. I think more actors should kind of sack up and do what they think is right versus what might be right for their career.
Mm. And actually do some research on the character you're playing.
Yeah.
Even just
that,
a little bit.
That I resent. That I have to say I'm against. Some of the greatest actors of all time don't believe in that, and it's not it isn't their responsibility to do that, and that's why the Hollywood machine as an independent filmmaker is dangerous. The actor is the unmolded clay, and it should be only the actor's responsibility to read a script and interpret what they want from it. That's a dangerous route to go, because then how much research are they responsible for? Are they responsible for understanding the entire history of the character if it's a long running character? No. Some of the most famous, Albus Dumbledore, the actor, the second Albus Dumbledore, never read a single book. Much beloved. Yes, he never read the books. He's in these interviews. People ask him about the movies and they're like, what does this mean? And he's like, I don't understand the movies. I just play Dumbledore.
Flip side of that, what's his name? Same movie, Snape. God damn it, what's his
Alan
name?
Alan Rickman.
Right, who demanded to know.
I don't know if he read the books like before getting cast, but he certainly read them in preparation, and I think he also churned an amazing performance out of it. So I think it is kind of up to the actor's discretion.
I guess I'm using my Harry Potter fandom a little bit too liberally. Snape, when they shot the movies when 6 had come out, and the 7th book had not come out, and he approached J.K. Rowling and said, I cannot play the character if you do not tell me why Severus Snape kills Dumbledore.
Yeah, so
He demanded to know why this character did this. He was totally the other way around.
Yeah, and I think with actors, that's usually the case, is, you know, there's method versus sort of the British model, where it's very much kind of a working class thing.
Yeah, I think it should be, you know, whatever. It shouldn't be a requirement to have to read the source material, but whatever helps the actor get into the role or the character the best way they can, I guess.
So a method
and
actor.
And I meant more. I didn't mean necessarily like build a character profile before playing your Hellboy side character. I meant more just like get the quick facts about, like, you know, like, oh, so he was this and he was supposed to be this race or whatever, just enough to, you know, like, is this even appropriate casting? But I don't know. I only see that benefiting a modern actor, just because so many people, because there is so much movie news that leads up to the actual release of the film, that you can actually create a shitstorm before, you know, a script has even been written. So
no such thing as bad publicity, Cassidy.
Let me throw this out there in terms of like what I don't like about filmmaking and film news in general, which is not mm-hmm. this story and not the way you're handling it. But I know we're trying to do hot takes, but I genuinely feel passionately about this. Unmolded clay, you know, model. That is the word for actor. That's where all these things come from. And in that same way, you know, I am a grumpy filmmaker. The best person to talk about the film is the nice, happy actor who's willing, who's not upset that you made them wait in a green room, who's not upset that they're waiting around for an interview, and can throw on a fake smile and do an interview. That's the reason they do interviews. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been to a film set, anyone out here, any film set, not just a big Hollywood film set or a big production film set or a big commercial film set, but if you've been to any film set, the idea that the actor is the one who knows the most going on is not just ridiculous.
Oh, it's
it is
insane.
On its face the most insane statement in the world. So actor the person you should be listening to is the groupthink attitude that I want to address right now. Is the actor responsible? The actor is barely responsible for feeding themselves on a film set. No less understanding what's going on the next hour. So they are not really in charge of the film. They are the highest paid low totem pole, I guess top of the totem pole if we're doing a politically correct thing here. But they are the lowest member of the team, but they happen to be paid a lot and they happen to be very pretty and they happen to be good at faking smiles. A DP is not going to be good at faking smiles. Go talk to a union grip guy. That's not a happy person.
I understand your argument to a point.
If you're gonna talk to someone, if you have two options, I want to understand all the ins and outs of these movies.
It's easier to replace.
And you have the option between the head grip and Tom Cruise. The head grip 100% understands the movie better than Tom Cruise.
Okay, understands the movie.
We're gonna have to park that.
I agree with your sentiment. I can come back on the show and we can just talk about the stupid issue.
Yes, I basically agree with your sentiment, and we'll leave it at that.
All right, Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi movie, early development at Disney, and the other big Star Wars news that just came out today, Colin Trevorrow, director of Safety Not Guaranteed and Jurassic World, is no longer going to be directing the last of the modern trilogy, Episode 9. So I guess they're still on the lookout for a new director there. Some names have been floated, but nothing's in stone.
Yes and yes.
As far as Star Wars, Obi-Wan, okay, here's the thing. Here's the thing, Star Wars. And I'm going to step on my soapbox for a minute.
Okay, let me push on your soapbox.
I love Star Wars. I love Star Wars. I love the Star Wars universe.
Sure.
Stop calling it a Star Wars extended film universe until we start getting some original fucking content that is in no way related to the original trilogy. All right.
Yes. Keith for president.
It is not a standalone movie. It literally, and I enjoyed the movie all right, but it literally ends with the beginning of A New Hope.
Don't be so nice. That fucking Verizon install movie, it was the worst piece of shit that Star Wars has ever made. It's 2 hours of, where's the modem going? Bum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum, ba-da-dum. It's the worst.
It is. Okay. I don't think it's the worst they've done, but it certainly doesn't hold up to the original standards.
Star Wars fans across the board are the guy that hasn't gotten laid in a while, and so now they're like, oh man, Rogue One is great, but they don't realize what a mean, horrible person Rogue One is, and that they and that they deserve better than Rogue One.
I agree basically with that. But my point is, it's not a standalone movie. It doesn't tell its own story. It is completely reliant on the mythology of the other movies. I want to see some, just like a movie, but a fucking X-Wing pilot that gets lost in the middle of the war and has to go on a swamp adventure and meet swamp friends. And he never knows how the war turned out. I want the enemy mine of Star Wars movies. where it's just like a fucking rebel and an Empire agent. They both get stranded on this fucking crazy planet and they have to survive together. And they never know what happens. They are completely taken out of the Star Wars and have their own fucking adventure. And we've never heard their name again before and we'll never hear it again. So that's how I feel about the Obi-Wan movie.
If I can give my quick takes, real quick on that too, I will say you should watch the original hand-drawn The Clone Wars, and you should watch the Disney Rebels series, which sounds like it's right up your alley as well, which
I've
is
heard
filled
good
with things like that. Yeah, which is really how this whole Star Wars got back going is that series and Timothy Zahn, of course. But adding to that hot take on the Obi-Wan movie, Star Wars is about Obi-Wan Kenobi. Obi-Wan Kenobi is the main factor in mostly every movie, every series.
Sure.
To announce that you're doing an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie only shows how lost they are.
Yeah, because it's like we've already that was supposed to be the prequels. Was supposed to be the Obi-Wan movie.
If you hadn't told me that you were going to follow up some way on Obi-Wan Kenobi and do more about Obi-Wan Kenobi, I would have been like, yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah. And as for Colin Trevorrow, I think it's probably for the best. I think that
what was Jurassic World about? Can someone tell me?
It was about nostalgia.
I mean, yes and yes. I mean, I think you're kind of joking, but you're not. As far as I'm concerned, it was a cynical take on, hey, this movie was really popular and this mythology is really popular. Let's do a reboot about reboots in the same way that Jurassic Park was. Let's do a movie about technology taking over.
It was kind of an indie director sneaking his snarky message into a big budget blockbuster movie.
I don't even think it was that high minded. I don't think he was like, oh, I'm sending up Hollywood. I think the movie's literally saying, and one of the reasons why I hated that movie is it was saying, you're a big, dumb, stupid audience. I'm going to make you a big, dumb, stupid movie. And that's essentially what the movie's about.
I think there's different takes on it. But I think Star Wars is better off with hopefully a more seasoned director. But I think Star Wars is kind of in the same place as Marvel at this point, where it's such a studio-driven venture that you're not going to really get... anybody's.
You can slot in just about anybody and probably get pretty close to the same result.
Yeah, I don't think Colin Trevorrow would have ruined Star Wars Episode 10, but I hope they get someone, just a little more.
So, just to connect these stories a little bit, because I really love your guys' take on them, but you actually made me like Jurassic World if the thing is to say, fuck you, you're going to make this movie no matter what I fucking say. Because
it's somewhere in between.
I'm from the New York school of film where we don't like big Hollywood, and Spielberg and Lucas were supposed to be the heroes to that idea that we're going to go to LA and we're going to take down big Hollywood. But also, weirdly enough, Lucas also said, I want to make Star Wars, which is supposed to be Flash Gordon. And what you just said, Keith, of you can slot in anyone or it's just lost and they're just making episodes. I mean, his goal was to make a serial. So it is a weird thing here where you have one director, Spielberg, who is much more big Hollywood than even George Lucas. And then maybe perhaps this self-awareness is going on. I don't know. We have to get them in truth serum one day.
I honestly think if there was any actual message to Jurassic World, it kind of snuck in on accident. And I don't know if he was entirely aware of the implication.
No way.
I think it was more just like a bunch of in jokes that he kind of snuck into his big blockbuster CGI jizz vest.
Yeah,
this really, is another really 15 minute hot take.
The only thing I wanted to say, I'm glad Trevorrow's out. I think they can do better. I'd like to see Spielberg again. He's never done a Star Wars movie. And As far as the Obi-Wan thing goes, I'm fine with them doing a standalone Obi-Wan Kenobi movie. I would like it to be very standalone in the way you said. If I were going to write a standalone Obi-Wan movie, I would do it as a samurai film. I would do it as Yojimbo with Obi-Wan.
Okay, now we're fucking talking.
Yeah, we're
They could
this.
Do
this
a whole series of Obi-Wan as like a Yojimbo type character, and I would be fucking down.
So here's why I love Obi-Wan Kenobi and why this is the second podcast where I've had to talk about how he's the most important. Obi-Wan Kenobi is the most powerful Jedi of all time, and people don't realize it. A, he is not as wild as Qui-Gon Jinn. He works within the Council. He exists at the height of the Jedi Empire. He is the first Jedi in 100 years, I think they say, to kill a Sith. And he kills the most Siths possibly ever since the original Great Wars. If you watch episode 3, the plan to take down General Grievous's starship, the head battleship, the flagship of this fleet, the plan is send Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi in. That is there. Remember that scene at the beginning of 3? These other guys, they fade away and they have to fight all these droids, and they go, And Obi-Wan goes, that's their job. That's not their job. This is ours. And their job is to go and take down an entire ship. Obi-Wan Kenobi, here's his stats. Darth Maul, Dooku, Grievous, Darth Vader, essentially. He kills all of them, really. You know, let's say Darth Vader's a reincarnation, which it truly is trying to be. That is the highest stats of fucking any Jedi you see. And to say that this movie, he introduces the Skywalkers, he's responsible for connecting the love connection. It's always – and if you think that Rey isn't Obi-Wan Kenobi's daughter, and I'm going there, then you don't understand the plot of the whole thing.
You know what? I'm gonna counterpoint that. With, maybe he was a good Jedi Knight, but he killed a bunch of motherfuckers. Jedis don't kill. Also,
of course they do. Wait, hold on. Let's get into this.
He's a real bad teacher.
Who says Jedis don't kill?
Killing is, I think a Jedi should be above killing. Killing is, it is a tactic of fear and hatred. Why would you kill? You kill to punish. You kill to preemptively strike. I am anti-death penalty, and I think a Jedi should be above killing.
Well,
you give a fucking Jedi the most deadly weapon in the universe, the lightsaber, and you tell him not to kill some motherfuckers with it. That takes dedication. That takes patience. That takes incredible grit. That's why Sith turn over like motherfuckers. It's way too easy to turn to the dark side and start killing people.
So you would say that Obi-Wan is actually more evil than Anakin, which is Anakin's theory. You would say that the height of the Jedi, which is implied, it's not a ridiculous theory, it's implied that the height of the Jedi, the idea that there's a Jedi temple and that there are hundreds of Jedi and no Sith, that this is an imbalance that is needed, that they have turned themselves into bloodthirsty killers and need to be taken down by someone like Anakin, and that he is the chosen one.
I do not agree with that. I think that the Jedi ideal is something to strive towards, but is impossible. And I think there is a point to its impossibility. I think you should strive towards the ideal. And the problem is the way they set up the dark side is like, oh, if you take a step to the dark side, you're gonna go Sith. And so people just do it because it's easy, because it's like, oh shit, I killed this alien. I guess I'm a Darksider now. You get fucking lightning bolts and pussy anyway. So I'm going to be fucking Darkside as fuck. I think the Jedi Order was always bad at training their Padawans, and that the struggle of the Force should be internal and not this external battle.
I'm hoping you're right, and the implication seems to be, Keith, that the next movie will be about that, you know, they are keeping part of these stories as canon, that we now know about two Jedi starships that have failed. Yoda ran one that fails, and that's in the Timothy Zahn books. And now Luke tries to do the same and that fails. And I think you're right to say that what this movie will be about is the lack of ability to temper this ideal. And I'm hoping that's there. But at the same time, I am in favor of Obi-Wan Kenobi having this massive amount of power.
If he is as powerful as you're saying, which I'm not going to dispute that, I think that there's enough evidence there, then he is a remarkable Jedi to show the patience and virtue that he does show. Again, just because he killed some people doesn't mean he's like full on dark side. I think, you know, his ideals were always there. He didn't kill out of fear or hatred. And I do think that makes a difference.
Siths are his big kill. And that's a big deal to say that you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi is generally
but that
a peaceful
guy. That means that you don't believe in rehabilitation, which is the whole point of the original trilogy, is that Darth Vader is not lost.
Now we're getting into the is it okay to punch Nazis argument.
Right.
Essentially.
Well, I like
which
the
is
idea.
Way too deep for this podcast.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever said the word rehab, but I like that a lot because, of course, the Sith are categorized by their amputees, and they have prosthetics and things like that. That is a clear visual indicator of the show. And so rehabilitation is a really interesting word to introduce, Keith. It's I don't know that we have time to talk about it here, but it is really, really interesting to say, you know, there are actually several rehab scenes, you know, that
you know
we
what?
Would
when the next Star Wars comes out, we'll have to have you back on so that we can just do a full fucking Star Wars special.
I'm so into it. I will get
I think we have to see those movies.
Yeah, and then I'll come back on here and I'll call you guys right from the theater, mouth full of popcorn, being like, "Oh, Obi-Wan Kenobi can suck my butt." Because now they have those drinking theaters, and that's really making Michael angry about summer blockbusters. What's the next hot take?
Well, we were going to do all of the Joker news, but let's just go ahead and get into the reviews. Oh, yeah. Basically, there's a bunch of Joker movies. Who cares?
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Get a new gimmick, Hollywood. We're not showing up.
Right. So me and Keith, let's go ahead and get into Logan Lucky. And then we'll, as a group, we will do the Death Note movie that Netflix put out.
Cool.
So we'll try and do a quickie on this one.
Take your time. Take your time. I know that's what people listen for. I'm hanging out. You know, I'm excited to get to hear an episode live. I'm excited to get to hear your take on it. So you do you. All right. Don't worry about me. Seriously.
You want to set this one up, Cass?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I just watched this last night. I had like the heistiest heist weekend.
God damn. You are such a procrastinator.
No,
you had 2 fucking weeks to watch this.
On Saturday, on my day off, Sunday, I went and saw a double feature at the Beverly of Jackie Brown and Out of Sight, Steven Soderbergh having directed Out of Sight, which is also a heist movie. And they'll kind of set the template for his Oceans movies. And they're definitely selling Logan Lucky as, if you like the Oceans movies, you're going to love Logan Lucky. To which I say, maybe not. Actually,
I mean, there's
a heist in this movie, but I think there's a lot of other stuff in there too. He kind of fits in his writerly obsessions or his thematic obsessions that don't necessarily go into paying off a heist film. But so this is about two brothers in North Carolina. One played by
North Carolina, West Virginia border.
West Virginia, yeah. Channing Tatum plays Jimmy Logan. He was supposed to be a high school football star and ended up not being able to. Kind of an underachiever. He goes into the construction world. And at the beginning of the film, we see him getting laid off by Jim O'Hare of Parks and Rec fame. Later, he meets his brother, played by Adam Driver, who is, speaking of amputees, missing an arm. Mm-hmm. And he had done 2 tours in Iraq, and he sort of has a very pessimistic outlook on his family and the world at large. And they decide to cook up this heist where they steal a lot of money from the a really famous NASCAR track over in West Virginia on the busiest day of NASCAR. And that's the stuff that's the most like the Ocean's movie. It's not a casino, but a lot of the ins and outs and a lot of how they go about pulling off this heist.
Yeah, and there's kind of this. It's kind of set up like the if anybody saw The Prestige, how they reveal the trick, the magic trick. It's sort of like that. Like you get some heist, and then there's some complications, and you think things are going to be a certain way, and then they reveal the trick and how everything was pulled off. And that to me felt very Ocean's 11. Like the whole, it's definitely not as slick and polished as the Ocean's movies, but
I would say as blatantly commercial as the Ocean's movies. Those were, you know, Steven Soderbergh really like saying, can I be just a Hollywood director? Can I be a man for hire? Whereas this movie feels a little bit more tourish in nature.
Yeah. It's almost like he's remaking his movies.
Kind of, yeah. And of course, this is the first movie he's done in like 3 years. He said he was never going to do movies. He did that TV show, The Nick, on Showtime, I think, with Clive Owen, and, you know, to mixed positive reviews. And he did the Behind the Candelabra was his last movie, which came out on HBO. But, you know, this was his kind of re-entry into the film world. And yeah, I liked the movie. But I had to be sort of patient with it because I was a little taken back by, first of all, they're selling it like this kind of wacky comedy, you know, like these people with these thick Southern accents. You have, James Bond, what's his name?
Daniel Craig is,
doing this very big over the top, bank robber character. And, you know, he's essentially steals every scene he's in.
Joe Bang. That was Joe Bang.
And they're selling it as this kind of eclectic cast, cuckoo bananas, sort of Coen Brothers light type thing. And actually, I felt more sort of shades of Magic Mike than I did necessarily the heisty stuff from Ocean's 11. I think this movie's essentially about the economy. And
yes, and I'm gonna I do agree with that, but and here's the thing, I really enjoyed the movie, but I almost think that's kind of a problem with the movie.
It's a little too lofty.
Well, it's like, is it a heist movie or is it not? Is it, you know, I also saw this a couple weeks ago. And so like I saw this like right in the height of all the controversy regarding the tearing down the Confederate statues. So I kind of already had a sour taste in my mouth for Southern pride going into this movie, but I still really enjoyed it. Like, you know, it has nothing to do with any of that. But that did kind of color my perception of it in a weird way.
Well, I do think there's a lot of zeitgeisty stuff in this movie. You have, you know, a lot of people talking about like the water being poisoned, them not being able to drink it because the government's not doing anything about it. Mm-hmm. There's talk of, you know, people being laid off of like coal mining jobs and these types of things. All of these talking points that we've been hearing for the last like two or so years makes its way in and about this movie, and it has a lot to do with the character's motivations. So I think it is a heist movie, but it feels a little bit more like a 70s heist movie where it's kind of about this sort of social malaise
than it is about, I agree with that completely. Like even if you look at heist, like the posters and stuff, I will say that's another thing I kind of wanted. You know, you have this poster that's this very like 70s sort of almost exploitation looking kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of Smokey and the Bandit sort of looking thing.
I will say I was a little disappointed that there wasn't like some kind of a crazy chase scene or, you know, which might be dumb, But you know, you hear about a fun heist movie where they're robbing NASCAR, you expect some kind of a crazy car chase at some point. And that's sort of my own fault. But you know, that's also how they kind of are marketing the movie.
Well, I frame my review by stating that the movie that they're marketing is very different from the one that you'll go see. But I do think that the one you'll go see is good, but you have to be patient with it because it takes a while to get to the genre stuff. And even after that happens, it still pays off spends a little bit more time paying off the thematics than like your average Ocean's 11 heist.
Yeah. Film. Yeah. And there are some things that, and here's the thing. Generally, Willie enjoyed the movie. And
I did,
and
too.
I think there was some smart filmmaking stuff going on. There was also some stuff that was kind of confounding to me. Mainly Seth MacFarlane and his fucking British accent.
Yeah.
Holy shit. What was
happening? I mean, the character is supposed to be an obnoxious clown anyway, so it didn't bother me that much, but it was... there.
It was distracting. It was, yeah. Like, it didn't, you know, some of the other accents were a little sketchy at times, which was fine, you know.
Catherine Watterson?
And Katie Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
But they didn't, like, they weren't, like, noticeably bad, whereas Seth MacFarlane, I was like, whoa, that made it in. and I generally enjoy Seth MacFarlane and was sort of surprised because voice work is sort of his milieu. But anyway, all of that being said, yeah, I thought it was a fun movie. It's ambitious in its subtlety and its
storytelling.
It's ambitious in its almost lack of ambition. Like, it's just a nice, kind of simple story, and I really, that's not something you get nowadays in movies, and so I enjoyed that about it.
I thought of it very much as like this year's the Nice Guys, whereas it was kind of a surprise where I went kind of expecting a thing, and I did get that thing, but it was also like, oh, this is feels kind of throwbacky in sort of a nice way. But
yeah, and almost, I can see the comparison, especially in kind of Steven Soderbergh referencing his greatest hits kind of thing, in the way that the Nice Guys sort of referenced a lot of Shane Black-isms. This kind of does that with Steven Soderbergh as well. I think that's actually a pretty fair comparison now that you say it.
But I mildly recommend it. I don't think it's essential to go see in a theater, but I did enjoy it. But it might alienate some people who are expecting, like, you know, a big fun romp. Because it's kind of melancholy. It's kind of minor key.
Yeah, but I still had plenty of fun with it. I would recommend it, especially with sort of the dregs that we're in right now. I would say this is probably the best movie in theaters at the moment that hasn't been out for 2 months.
Maybe.
I had fun. I think people who want the fun romp will get that out of at least Daniel Craig's performance.
Sure.
And the Bang Brothers in general. They were all pretty campy and fun.
The functionality of the heist itself. It's very kind of Rube Goldberg like in how many components there is and who has to be where when to make this thing pull off. And then it kind of flips and reverses.
I think it's, I had a lot of fun with the movie, and I think it's a really smart movie, which is kind of rare these days.
Well, specifically for this type of genre.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get into Netflix's Death Note. And Mike, actually, since you read the manga.
I have the black notebook, which is a special edition, which comes with all the alternative covers, every single chapter. I think Death Note is by far one of the greatest animes ever written. I mean, manga's ever written. Excuse me. I said anime out of turn. I've never watched. Here's how dedicated I am to the manga. Never watched the anime because I have a very strong relationship with Ryuk and all the characters involved, and I don't want to ruin the things in my mind. So it was, right. It was a
I
great
bet
pain.
You fucking loved this.
Well, you would at Vegas odds would tell you yes, but you would have bet the wrong way because goodness, it's as if someone said, "Hey, I read all these Death Note books. Okay, you're fired."
Why don't you describe a little bit, like what is the Adam Wingard American remake do differently, or at the very least, what's going on here? What does it do differently?
Is not a question anyone can answer. It's all different. It is 100% different show and movie than the book.
And there's
no way to say, you know, if this is a Harry Potter book 7, for example, I can tell you exactly what they did wrong and why they needed to add this and take this away and keep to the story here and not keep to the story here. There's no reason for me to list the things that are different about it. The inherent idea that Ryuk is funny and not an idiot. It ruins the entire story. The idea that this is an action story that has anything to do other than with word puzzles is ruined. The entire, these police fight scenes in the books are taken as jokes. You know, you have to understand that the characters involved, Kira or Light, believes he's God. He genuinely believes he's God. And for a lot of the novel, there's a great amount of evidence that he is God, that he will become the angel of death. And so for this to be engaging at all, you know, these scenes are totally wrong. They watch these scenes being like you and I would play chess is how they watch them. And that's what's engaging about Death Note, is the idea that here is a 17-year-old, 18-year-old boy who finds death nothing more than a tool to become the ruler of the universe. And that is completely lost. It is Friday the 13th. It is I Know What You Did Last Summer. And then there is some beautiful CGI with a character that was absolutely ruined. Instead of watching Death Note, I recommend you watch the Pen Pineapple Apple Pen CGI test that the same CGI company did a few months ago.
Yeah, I really enjoy that.
And then just read the manga, because fuck this movie. So it's as if they were like, all the interesting aspects, throw them out. Sorry, I went on for a while.
Yeah, so let's talk about the movie that we got, because Cassidy and I have no relationship with the manga and the anime whatsoever. I mean, I'm vaguely aware of it as a cultural entity, but so to summarize the story of this movie, Light Turner, which Jesus Christ, I mean, I get that they're adapting this from a manga.
I think I must have had a cluster headache the whole time. His name's Light Turner.
Yeah, you translated half his name. What the fuck? Anyway, so he finds a notebook that it has a bunch of
imagine
rules
if Superman's name was Clark Esperanto. That's how stupid this sounds. You understand that I literally must have blacked out. I'm telling you guys, like, I don't have any memory problems. I have a perfectly I actually have had you know I have migraines, so every once in a while someone scans my brain. I have no issues. I literally must have, in some sort of weird PTSD, Light Turner. Oh my gosh, I didn't even notice.
So Light Turner finds a
Luke,
mysterious
Luke
notebook.
Goldberg instead of Luke Skywalker. What else is next?
That when he writes a name in this notebook, it's accompanied by a mischievous demon. That when he writes a name in this notebook and describes the way they will die, they die. And then hijinks ensue.
Right. He has a girlfriend named Mia, who is a little bit more excited about the potential of this book and
Is it Mia Sutton? Mia Sutton! Oh my gosh! That's amazingly bad! Oh my god, so her name is Misa Amune in the books, and she is the most Japanese girl you could ever meet. She is a J-pop star in addition to being part of Japanese soap operas. And so to go from Misa Amune to what was yours?
Mia Sutton.
Oh my god, she runs a deli. That is the worst. Oh my god. Guys, I'm not kidding. I watched this movie. This is weird.
So, yeah. And then this sugar addicted detective who goes by the moniker L, because part of the rule of this notebook is you have to know their name and know their face or it won't work. So he comes around in a mask and his name is L. He's trying to figure out who's responsible for there's a bunch of deaths of bad people, of killers, right, and terrorists,
gangsters,
and
rapists, so, and whatever. Yeah,
so yeah. Part typical of this too, Dexter. It's okay to murder these people because they're bad people. Sort of mythology, which a Jedi wouldn't do.
Okay,
but that's beside the point.
L, by the way, they got that wrong. L is a just in the same way many people say James Bond is not a real person, that James Bond is a moniker,
is a code name. Yeah,
there is a great love for detective stories, and even the name Kira is a Japanization of Killer, which was a very famous Sonny Chiba movie.
Yes.
So a lot of these things are lost. The idea that L is covering his face because he knows about the death eyes, which he doesn't. He figures it out later very, very logically. And L is a moniker, a mysterious moniker anyway, to indicate that already fighting crime is brave. That there is always supposed to be this is again lost on the movie. There is this juxtaposition between L, Light's dad, who is the chief of police and is not afraid to endanger his family, and L, who may get the job done, but is there honor in what he does? Is he just as bad as Kira? Which is they kind of hang on to that point in the movies, which I liked. But otherwise, you know, the idea that he's only L because he knows about this power is taking away from the idea that the author is suggesting Sherlock Holmes is more of, it doesn't matter if Sherlock Holmes dies, there will always be a Sherlock Holmes. There will always be a Dr. House. There will always be a Batman.
Gotcha. So, Cassidy, what did you think, as a non-fan, what did you think about this interpretation of the movie?
As a non-fan who didn't know much about, I knew, like, there's a magic book, there's a demon that follows him around. That's pretty much all I knew about it, was what you can get from the cover of a DVD at Sam Goody.
Yeah.
That's what I knew about Death Note. And we had some, like, anime friends who kind of were into it when it was big. I thought my biggest problems with the movie were movie problems, not necessarily adaptation problems. One being, it's definitely under budget for what it is, and other than the really good CGI for Willem Dafoe's demon character, Ryuk, that seems to be the only thing they use the budget on. Some of the editing is so terrible, and the transitions from what was obviously first and second unit, or even third unit, and then, you know, people just doing exterior shots and that kind of stuff, you could tell that they were trying. It reminded me of, like, really old, like almost like canon era movies where they were trying to, like, fill out the script as much as possible with some sort of scene. So they would just construct them out of first, second, and third unit footage. On a story level, I think the movie's terrible, mostly because it's so, you can tell that they took, maybe I'm wrong here, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but you can tell that they took a really long, like, one or two seasons of the show.
Yeah.
Or of the graphic novel or the manga, and compressed it into an hour 40. And it reminded me of M. Night Shyamalan's terrible Last Airbender, where all the movie is that it's scenes of exposition. Like, the dialogue is almost entirely expository. It's about explaining the game board rules And if you do this and you can't do that, but we've already done this. And, you know, if you're going to do this, well, then you're going to have to tear the page and burn the thing. And
I also feel like the rules were not consistent. And I, again, right. I don't know how that compares to the manga. But
to add to that really quickly, so you guys can keep talking. In the book, it's quite a reveal. You they all make sense in the end, is sort of the way it is.
Which I mean, when it's being sussed out over, you know, multiple volumes, like, right, that makes sense. But when he's literally reading it and skips to 99 and he's like, how many rules are there? And I'm like, okay, I don't know how much the rules matter. And I don't know if the movie knows how much the rules matter.
I wish the movie had decided they mattered less. Like, I mean, as far as adaptations go, I don't know what that would have done. But I would have really liked them to truncate as much of that as possible just to stick on the character stuff. I actually don't think that, like, Nat Wolff, who plays the main character, and Margaret Qualley, who plays his girlfriend, and
she's really good in The Leftovers, you know, they're, by the way.
Oh, she's in, okay. I was wondering, where is this person? Why is she in our life right now? But yeah,
she's the daughter.
And I
love actors Lakeith, like that.
Lakeith Stanfield, who's becoming one of my favorite, it's that guy. He was in Get Out. He was in Straight Outta Compton. He played Snoop Dogg. And
who's he in Get Out?
He was the guy at the beginning of the movie who gets kidnapped, and then he's like,
you're right,
with the older lady. Yeah. He's a really, really fun, charismatic actor, and he gets to do a lot of, like, physical comedy.
I want to throw this in just real quickly to continue, guys, because I'm interested in hearing what you say. Great choice to be, even manga-wise, even whatever, it is a great choice to make that person a different race, because it doesn't matter to the story. It only makes it more mysterious if he's not of the same nationality or whatever. Great choice. Great choice. Great choice of changing whitewashing into, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, which I know there was some controversy with this being, you know, whitewashed, and the, you know, they're.
I think that's the least of the
I want to go. I want to go on the record, and say that just because something is from Japan originally does not mean that the characters have to be Japanese. You know, I think what matters as far as the race of a character go is how much it matters to the story. That being said,
I don't consider this whitewashing. I consider this an American.
A lot of people did,
and I think there's a difference.
Do you guys know about the corners of the world file path, which is essentially English people are obsessed with the Orient, as they would call it in the era in which it begins. I wouldn't say the Orient, but English people have Japophilia. In which they love tigers and they love the Asian things, and they're always wanting to import. Their culture entirely now is based on tea, an entirely Asian import. Asians and Japanese people in particular have an American obsession. They are Amerophiles. They love Elvis. They love rock and roll. They love jeans. And Americans, of course, in an irony, a twist, we love Britain. We love the Beatles, and we love biscuits, and we love cookies, and we love the Shakespeare and plays, which we have pioneered. We are, you know, England, which should be the king of plays. We are now, America is, of course, the king of plays. We you know, movies, Hollywood, we are the theater center of the world. There is a cycle there in which, you know, Americans end up making weird things about Britain and vice versa, and Japan and all those things.
Yeah. That's my point. It's like, if we're going to do an American adaptation, they don't have to be Japanese. I think that controversy was a little unnecessary, but whatever. If people want to get upset about that, I get it. So my take on Death Note was, start of it, I was kind of okay. I was like, okay, this is kind of campy, and this does definitely have a horror, almost horror comedy vibe. And then they introduce the character of L, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on now? And it turns into this weird, like, private investigator, cat and mouse thing, which I think could have worked, but it did not in this case. And I think largely it did have to do with sort of convenience writing and editing. Like, mm-hmm. I'm just going to hold a press conference in the middle of nowhere, even though nobody knows who I am, and I'm wearing a hoodie and a mask because that's how press conferences work. You know, and that sort of like convenience stuff started to just slowly take this movie over for me to the point where I was getting just really annoyed by it. Like I liked Willem Dafoe as Ryuk. Again, I'm not familiar with the source material. I thought he was a mischievous, you know, demonic creature. I felt like I wanted to have more fun with that. I thought the movie was going to be more about him, like
fun, and that's what it was. This Rumpelstiltskin, this dark Rumpelstiltskin character, is boring compared to the normal Ryuk, who is sort of like almost a Mad Max character, who is like, I'm along for the ride. Like he is Light's number one fan, but can't really choose sides. And he is like, he loves the gore and violence, and he's just like,
yeah, like I think that could have been a lot more interesting. Like I thought he was gonna be almost more like a gremlin. Like,
here's how scary Light is as a character in the books, Keith. In the books, Light, remember, Ryuk is an eternal demon who's existed since the beginning of time. In the books, Light, a 17-year-old boy, is kind of the plight of Ryuk's world. It is not the other way around. Ryuk is not haunting Light. Light is this terrifying new god named Kira who has control over a demon. Like, Ryuk's life is ruined by Light in the books, and he has control over him, and a lot of demons are sort of annoyed by Light because he is Kira. He is a god who has control over demons. Kira is in many ways, you know, upside down crosses and pentagrams are sort of a known jewelry thing of the pop scene, and that's how Misa dresses in the books. And there is a lot of indication that Light is the new Antichrist, and it's awesome as compared to this Rumpelstiltskin character who is not really into the gore. Who is the bad guy? Who is the good guy? It's not really interesting in that way. They don't make any choices.
Well, I have theories as to why that is. I think part of the what Netflix had envisioned and what Adam Wingard ended up doing with this, which I should say, Adam Wingard is generally a director I like, having done Your Next and The Guest, and low budget horror director. But I think what they tried to do with this is they kind of tried to turn this into a superhero movie.
No,
I mean there is
Do you know what they tried to turn this into? You know what this movie was? It's a really shitty supernatural version of Heathers, but without any of the comedy.
Yes, that is what this fucking is.
Yes, I thought of that as well. Yes, it without any of the irony.
And that's my problem with it, is I think that could have worked.
Or True Romance or any of those kind of movies,
But the characters were way too earnest about everything, and
the movie didn't have the conviction to turn Light into
a bad person.
A bad person. They wanted to keep him redeemable, which is a very American concern. Yes.
It's the worst. Light is the most sociopathic character, and you have to agree with him because it's the only reason Light is at all likable is because He's sociopath to the point of turning back into logic, where it's like, you know, it almost gets philosophical. It almost gets Dalai Lama-like, where he goes, you know, why should I, you know, my family, who cares? My family's life versus the life of so many other people that these criminals will kill, like, why would I care about that? It becomes very philosophical and deep, as opposed to saying, like, he care. He never literally in the books, many times it becomes a thing where Misa says, who's Mia, I guess now, Mia Sultan. but Misa in the books, he at times is like, if she dies, I won't have the eyes anymore. I won't be able to see people's names without the face. Like, he doesn't care. He does not like Misa. And the cuteness of Misa's character is to say, oh, she still loves him. Isn't that stupid and cute? And that she still loves the devil, even though he hates, he does not care. It's this Kohai Senpai thing where this small amount of affection he shows for Misa is huge, because he's mostly like, I need to use her to kill people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like they totally flipped their relationship, kind of.
They made it with stakes.
In this,
yeah,
she was like a sociopath, which I didn't mind. I just wanted him to be just as bad. Like, I wouldn't have minded.
Because it leaves the more, like, and this is the problem I had with Dexter. This is the problem I have with this. And the problem with this idea of sort of like the lovable sociopath is that it actually makes it much more reprehensible what he's doing when you're trying to redeem the character at all costs, depict the character as being as evil as he truly is. That actually is more morally sound on a extratextual level.
Yeah, right. because then you don't have people in the audience saying, "Oh, I this is my cipher. I could be this person." Yeah. You know, I wanted this movie to have some balls and say, you know, our main character is the villain, and that's okay. And I think that's what's frustrating, is I think there could have been like a fun, again, take away the adaptation stuff, because I don't know if they could have condensed it. You know, adaptations, they don't.
Tricky business.
Yeah. And my opinion is, you know, it's kind of where I'm at with like the Marvel movies and stuff is I don't necessarily care if they get all the comic stuff right anymore, as long as they, you know, tell a fun story and make a good movie. And I agree.
Guardians of the Galaxy is the best example of that. Who the fuck has ever heard of Guardians of the Galaxy until this thing came out? Even you and I are big comic book readers, Keith. Who the fuck? Guardians of the, you might as well make a Metal Men movie. Like, who the hell cares?
Right? Yeah, exactly. And they took the idea, some of the ideas, and they adapted it, and they took their own perspective on that. And I think they could have done that with this movie. You know, some diehards would still be upset. That's going to happen.
But I'll say this for the diehards. It's just that they tried to do too much. It's the case with a lot of books I like, where they get worried. And here's my perspective on it as a filmmaker. Someone gets worried that they won't get funding for the next movie. And so instead of focusing on, well, what is a 20-page story in a comic book that I can turn into an hour and a half and really dig my teeth into and develop some of this dialogue more than the comic book fashion where you got to understand, they make a manga every single week. We don't do that in America.
No,
right. We make a comic book every month for a trade. If that, Kevin Smith has decided that it's a 2-year time period.
I'm still waiting for Umbrella Academy Volume 3.
As is he. He's wondering who's going to write it for him. But the point is, Kevin Smith just sits around every day opening that Word document, Keith, going, who is going to write this thing? There are no more pages in here, but
Same thing with George R. R. Martin, yeah.
Yeah. But instead of saying it's happened with my favorite things, it's happened with Seventh Son, also known as The Last Apprentice. It happened with Aragon, and it's happened with this, which is that it is such a widely breathed story that the filmmaker immediately gets excited and nervous. And the problem is they all those movies, the coincidence is, it's not a coincidence that they hire a green director in terms of high budget stuff. And it's not a coincidence that they come out rushed.
Right. And it's, you know, they have the name, so they're going to get the viewers, and that's all that matters. They don't have to actually
deliver,
make a movie that takes a stance on anything, that actually has any balls or point of view or a voice. And that's what frustrated me, was I felt like Adam Wingard was trying to pepper in all of this substance with like the weird 80s soundtrack, which, by the way, didn't make sense for this movie because it did not seem like it was set in the 80s, but whatever.
No, 2000s. What the fuck is with it? No, wait, it's, sorry, I'm sorry. It's, this series was written in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. Right. So again, I don't know what the 80s soundtrack was supposed to do other than 80s stuff is still in vogue.
I think that's pretty much it. It's and because probably Adam Wingard was in high school in the 80s, so he's evoking his own teenage years.
Yeah, I guess so. Because I felt like there was this sort of style trying to sneak its way in, and I thought there were a couple kind of
There's too many objectives, like Mike was saying, that the movie has too many things it's trying to do. It's trying to get trying to chew through all of this exposition and suss it out in a way that's at all comprehensible, which they don't. And it's also trying to like pay off all this action movie stuff that barely works. It's trying to pay off all this horror stuff that just seems really out of place, like these shock gore scenes just feel like they're from another movie. And
it's like, just pick one. Just, you know,
it ultimately none of it really works. I wrote in my review, I'm going to quote myself. It felt like a gloomy CW Spider-Man pilot meets an emo version of Jim Carrey's The Mask meets an inept Donnie Darko.
Wow. That is dead on.
That's pretty accurate. You forgot Heathers, but...
And the Heathers thing as well, yeah.
Well, inept Donnie Darko, I think Heathers is supposed to be of that same genre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She loves him, like, even though he's a time-traveling weirdo.
Sort of goth-punky...
And I actually, I could see, like, a 13-year-old who isn't aware of all of these better things that came before it, maybe clicking on Netflix and this being their jam for a summer until they see any of the movies it's referring to or seeing any or reading the original content.
Go through the whole anime or manga or whatever, because that's probably what
this is. This is kind of like, this is sort of like, you're a lonely geeky outsider in eighth grade 101 type material.
Yeah, this is, and that's another thing that bothered me about it, is it's sort of tween-age power fantasy, completely irresponsible and without any actual moral consequences. So, yeah. So, I probably would have loved it in high school. And
I wouldn't say high school. I would say seventh grade, maybe.
There's a version. Wait, hold on. I'm trying to clarify from you guys. There's a version of you that loves this movie.
I would say sixth, seventh grade. After that, I'm going to say no.
Yeah, like, I think that it's gory enough that the part, but safe enough that the part of me that was kind of flirting with edgier stuff would have really enjoyed that. Even now, even watching it now, I actually liked some of the gore because I thought it was at least creative. I liked the darker side of this movie.
Oh, let me throw out there so that nobody gets it twisted. The CGI, the effects in this movie, it is what makes me even sadder that it's an anime I like. I mean, a manga that I like. And what makes me even sadder that it is a great story that I like is that oh my gosh, I could stare at that Ryuk for hours. I could stare at those
gore. Yeah.
It was so masterfully done. And then to ruin that hard work from people.
I agree, because I thought Willem Dafoe's performance was really fun, and I thought the imagining of Ryuk and the way they never like fully revealed him, but you still got to see enough to know what's there as this sort of almost comedic boogeyman. I dug that, and I wanted
But then for me, I would say, well, then change it to a Beetlejuice type story where goofy things happen. Because
I agree. I agree 100%. Make it more.
The fun of Ryuk is that there's this really dark shit happening, and then Light tosses him an apple, and he's happy. You know, that's the fun of him. It isn't that there's these two dark presences, or I guess one really in the end, because Light is not at all dark in this one. He's very. Very
relatable. Pussy. He's a fucking
Spider-Man. That's a great way to say it. He is a he is an Andrew Garfield Spider-Man. Yeah. The reluctant hero. He is not at all that way. Everyone else, like, there is actually a theme in the books, which I don't want to be that person who's like, the book's this, but there's a theme in the books, which is to say everyone else doesn't think they're a hero. He meets policemen, you know, his dad's the chief of police, who don't think of this job as hero worthy. And sees himself as very godly and holier than thou. And so it's this thing of like, no one in the real world thinks they're a hero.
Yeah, so basically, I think this wasn't a great movie and wouldn't recommend it.
No.
I would recommend watching the CGI. I would recommend, as I told to Rod from Listening Party Podcast, we spoke about it on Instagram. I said, just go through, see when there's CGI or death, and that's good enough.
Right.
I say just watch Donnie Darko and Heathers, and you're good.
Yep. Yep, I'm fine with that as well.
Cool. So, moving on.
Yeah, let's get into the Netflix homework. We're going to be talking about The Iron Giant. And Keith, set that up. What happens in The Iron Giant?
The Iron Giant, a young boy in Maine, somewhere in Maine, nondescript during like the 60s communist,
Cold War.
Yeah, communist Red Scare era. He's a lonely boy whose mom is just kind of working to pay the bills. And this, the town was called Rockwell, which I thought was pretty funny. And he is a lonely boy with a big imagination. A giant robot from outer space lands in his backyard, and he slowly becomes friends. Meanwhile, a government agent who fancies himself a McCarthy is hunting down this robot, thinking it's some kind of communist invader to destroy it.
This is directed by Brad Bird, who also would later go on to do the Incredibles and the, I think, Ghost Protocol Mission Impossible, which was one of my favorite ones.
I mean, I feel like if you're a fan of Brad Bird, like, this is sort of, this is definitely him at his most Brad Birdist, you know, very idealistic. The ideas of playing into youth. I feel like I'm doing a really bad job with this one.
America.
Can I work in movie news for a second here as well? To focus in. The trailer for Ready Player One has come out, and the obvious links between this movie and Ready Player One are sort of coming around. It is essentially a Ready Player One adaptation.
In the in the book Ready Player One, they briefly mention Iron Giant. It was just like a very passing reference, but it's become pretty clear that the movie will be pretty different from the book. And at Comic-Con, Steven Spielberg said the Iron Giant will actually play kind of a big part in Ready Player One, which was sort of what made me want to watch the Iron Giant, because I've always thought the character design was great.
Yeah,
and the animation of this movie is gorgeous.
It was one of those weird things where somehow me and Keith didn't see this when it came out, when it was a kids movie for kids. We were the exact right age to see it. We were, you know, I think maybe like in sixth grade or something when this movie came out originally. No, 99. We would have been a little bit older.
We would have been ninth grade. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's why. But yeah, I think that I'm gonna say it. I think this is kind of a perfect movie.
Great.
A lot of times when you see,
I'm a big fan of Iron Giant. Yeah,
a lot of times when you see kids' movies as an adult for the first time, you didn't grow up with it as a kids' movie as a kid. Mm-hmm. Then you'll go back and watch this old thing that everyone quotes constantly, and everyone it's very, very close to them, and you just don't have that connection because it just didn't hit you at the right age. This is not that. I fell in love with this movie while watching it, and I don't think it makes a single misstep. It gets the Americana thing totally right. It gets the thematics of the sort of the Cold War tension and all of that stuff.
I don't think enough can be said for how gorgeous the animation is.
It looks beautiful. Yeah,
one of the first instances of cel shading in a feature length movie. Iron Giant is cel shaded. Yeah.
And it blends so well with the rest of the animation that it doesn't feel weird. It doesn't feel experimental. You know, it just looks so pretty.
Mm-hmm. I will say this about kids' movies, and you know, I don't necessarily believe in kids' movies or whatever. But I will say this:
I don't either.
If you're making a kids' movie, one of the things that this movie does well and Toy Story do well, which is mostly a crap series, I want to let that note to everybody.
Disagree.
Watch Toy Story. Toy Story 1, great movie. Watch Toy Story 2 and 3 and start the movie going, I don't care about these characters, and you will realize that it's a bad movie. But what I will say about Toy Story 1, which is different, and what Iron Giant does really well, is that why it is a good kids movie is because it does not hold anything back, but it is from the perspective of the kid. So when the military person is there, the military person hides stuff from the kid. As much as they can hide this violence from the kid, they're going to. The artist is going to hide most of his lifestyle from the kid. He's trying to be respectful to the kid. You know, the kid gets a hold of coffee and he goes nuts with it. The mom's struggle at the restaurant, she tries to hide from the kid. This is why it relates to kids and why a kid can relate is just the same things that are being hidden from you when you're 11 or 12 or 13 as a character is, I guess we never, I think they probably say his age at some point. But those are the same things being hidden from you. Violence and sex and love life and job and money. Though it's not necessarily that those things aren't important, R.E., the Rugrats, where you don't have any understanding of it. Yet the Rugrats also does this well, where it is your understanding of it at the time. It shows how an artist would let a kid into his life. It shows how an artist would, how a mom would let a kid into the struggling world of being a single mother and a waiter.
Yeah.
In 1950.
Yeah, for sure. And they layer on that subtext of setting and time period so well. It's sort of frustrating how often we have to keep saying this, but it's still surprisingly relevant. Like, you know, they're teaching these kids how to deal with nuclear war, and it's like, oh, well, we kind of thought that went away, but maybe not. You know, and they do such a good job of painting that setting and that time period in a way that even if it wasn't still relatable today, you get such a good sense of time and place and what the ideal is they're trying to capture. And at the end of the day, it was just like heartwarming and endearing and fun. It's sort of like a slightly more grown up version and better. I don't want to say better, but it reminded me kind of a lot of The Brave Little Toaster.
Okay. So funny, me too, yeah.
It has that tone, that sort of... Well, and I think Brave Little Toaster was a huge inspiration on the Toy Story series.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think tonally that, especially.
That idea of, like, not having a place, but, you know, family sort of makes the place and
making and, your own family.
Yeah, and also just sort of the art style in general reminded me of
the found objects kind of thing.
I am sort of horrified that I did not see this movie sooner because it has everything I love in it. It has giant robots, mostly that.
You love like motorcycle beatniks too. That's one of your favorite things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And coffee. I do enjoy a good coffee shop diner.
Have you ever seen the Cartoon Network series? I believe it's called Big Eight, which is sort of a play on this and the Big O.
Oh no! It could be good.
I'll have to remember what the real name of it is. I think we're going to lose you in about 30 seconds, Cassidy.
Sorry.
I think you're about to lose your recording in about 30 seconds.
No, I'm looking at it right now. We're at I have 6 minutes 31 seconds.
Yeah, I also calculate you being 6 minutes.
Yeah.
So yeah, glad we watched The Iron Giant. I'm excited to see him appear in Ready Player One. I hope
almost exactly the same. I want to say, if you haven't seen The Iron Giant, go watch it now. And then, I mean, he's just doing it. I mean, they are now all the same company. So I think Spielberg is just like, give me the files.
I just hope it doesn't tarnish the legacy. But this movie's just really good. If you haven't seen it, it definitely holds up because I enjoyed a lot of it.
You said Brave Little Toaster. I also thought of sort of a modern take, or I guess not modern because it takes place even, you know, it's still sort of a nostalgia piece to a certain extent. But it reminded me a lot of the original Pete's Dragon. Well.
Yeah, like the sort of misfit boy who has he's not an imaginary friend, but he serves sort of the same purpose.
Right.
He relates to this kid in a way that no one around him can. Also, The end when he flies up into space and says all the he's
things,
Superman.
All the things, yeah. They yeah. kind of, the Big Hero 6 sort of stole that a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. And just the idea of it. I'm a sucker for idealism and hope. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if it gets me right, if it's well done, I think it's the best. Like just the scene where he's teaching the Iron Giant he doesn't have to be a horrible death machine, and it's good. There's a little bit of Terminator peppered in there.
Yeah. Well, I always took away from, and maybe this is a dark take of it, but you know, of course, he my interpretation of the thing to have you think more and more rather than taking the easy morals is that the Iron Giant is built, of course. He has to be built. A robot has to be built. And mm-hmm. yes, he does sacrifice himself. But what is the Cold War lesson I always took away from it? And I've talked about this on Almost Educational, that I feel as though I'm closer to the Cold War than a lot of people from my generation. But with the takeaway is that, but he is built by a society that knows that this robot will be blown up. Remember, he's a robot. And
sure,
this is the terrifying thought. That not that the robot exists, not that there's a terrible, powerful robot, but that a society existed in which a nuclear bomb would blow up this robot on the premise that it could put itself back together.
Yeah, I get that. But the thing is, no, I get that.
It's a less happy ending. I'm sorry for ruining it, but that's how I see it.
But it's also, you know, it is about that hope and idealism, because the Iron Giant learns that he's more than a weapon, you know, that he's right. Yes, even though he might have survived the destruction of his entire society or possibly even planet, he is more than just that. That alone right. does not define him. And we get to see him through Hogarth's eyes of, understanding despite the potential fear. He's different. He's giant. He is literally a weapon. But Hogarth just sees his friend.
I believe one of Vin Diesel's last lines is addressing Hogarth. I think that's one of the last pieces of dialogue you hear, is that he's put back together and says hi to his friend.
Oh, I think the last thing he says is, I'm Superman.
I'll let Mike go first. Mike, where do people find you?
Right now, I'm seriously trying to. I know a lot of the podcasts, the podcasters that are listening right now that I'm talking to, Soundbite is the reason that I wanted to do a guest spot with Almost Educational. And I'm so happy after so long of being interested in you guys. Being able to come on is Soundbite, SoundByte. Let's Start a Cult Podcast, which I do, is a user on there. And we've done a whole comedy series for there. And this app is just about, like, I believe in the 14-second format. And I think Soundbite does as well. And we're creating a whole series on there. And I love it. I hope that every podcast sort of treats Soundbite as this way to create, like, a new podcast. I think the 14-second format is new media. It's true new media. And I think, like, if you guys, for example, I'm sure you, like me, watch an episode of a TV show or watch a movie almost every night, mm-hmm. I would love to see a version of this podcast in which it's just your thought on what 14 seconds on whatever you watch that night. I think the short form of new media is really important to me. And me and Deepu are doing this Let's Start a Cult Podcast things where we're doing educating Deepu, where Deepu's a fucking idiot and refuses to learn, refuses to read a book. He has not read a book. If he doesn't read a full book before December, he will have not read for an entire decade.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting on that. And so Educating Deepu is a great series we're doing on Soundbite, where Deepu has to – I asked him what conscription was, and he said it was an old-timey way of writing the Constitution as opposed to the draft, which is what it is, in case any listeners are embarrassed for the moment. But
I had no idea what it was, so –
But we did some other comedy stuff where Deepu really shines. We did Veggie Dating Service, which is where we have vegetables pitching themselves on why they're sexy and dateable. And we did Caveman Explain, where we play two cavemen. But I love the 14-second format, and I hope that – I think it's a format of podcast that any – like I think it takes a lot of talent to do what us three do, filling in a half an hour and a half, 2 hours. I think that takes a lot of talent and a lot of commitment. I don't think that the average person can do it. I think that, but the average person can think of a great 14-second series. And I think that's what I love about podcasts. I love when the average person finds a way to make themselves fantastic through audio, because I love audio. And I think that's where soundbite shines. Are you a traveler? Are you a biker? Are you whatever? Give me 14 seconds of your life, just genuine emotion. I think that's what's great about it. That's all I really have to plug.
Okay. Nice. What about your Twitter? Do you want people to follow you there?
Sure. Big Little Weasel. BIGLIL Weasel, if you know how to spell weasel. You can find everything I do there.
All right, Keith, where do people find you?
Follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. Follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Check out tonightinsandiego.com. Follow Tonight in San Diego on all those things I just mentioned. We're also coming back for another 12 weeks. So 12 long weeks. I'm so excited. Come check out our live tapings, because they are a lot of fun. We do put a lot of work into the show. And if you come out, you'll probably have a good time. And if not, then I'm sorry. Every Monday at the Jeffrey Theater in downtown San Diego at the show starts at 8. That's all right now.
Okay. And as far as you can follow me at BC Cassidy, V as in Victor, CCASSIDY. And you can follow the show at Jabber Podcast. Tweet anything you want to us. You tweet us suggestions for Netflix homework. Tweet us your agreements or disagreements with our opinions on the show, whatever it may be. You can also
tweet us live tweet a movie you're watching.
Yeah, that's always fun.
You guys going to get bothered by me a lot now. I'm going to start doing that.
Just use the hashtag Netflix homework.
Yeah, if you happen to be watching the movie we're watching for the week, which, Keith, I never told you, we're watching Spike Lee's first film from 1986, She's Gotta Have It.
That's
what we'll be talking about next week. And if you want to email us for anything that any of the discussion we had here, or you want to weigh in on something we talk about, you can do that at jabberinthedrone.com. jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can find the show at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. That's our regular archives, and you can find our RSS feed. You can also find us and stream us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, player.fm, Google Play, all the things. And be sure to listen to our other friends who have podcasts. Mike at Let's Start a Cult.
Let's Start a Cult. Yeah, it's on iTunes. If you search Let's Cult, if pretty much if you search anything like that, Let's Start a Cult, you'll get us. Yeah,
I found
it. We're on iTunes.
I found it. Good. I subbed. Rod Denise at the Listening Party. Denise at Mascot Diaries, and Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Also, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast. So. Without further ado, thank you for joining us, Mike. Unusual but very fun episode.
Let me say, literally anytime. Literally, like night or day, send me a message. I am here. This was so anyone that's
we're going to get into it for Star Wars.
I am so you have no idea how much bonus audio. I'm going to bring a lapel mic to the fucking theater. I am so excited.
I'm gonna say let's give it to Gosling, and may the force be with you.